The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2023. This is now the third night. We've got four streams coming up. And the first one is with Harry Robinson, widely known as the most based Lotus Eater. I don't know how many people have said that.
That's a bit tongue-in-cheek. I'll be perfectly honest with you. That's a little bit tongue-in-cheek. A few have said that, but it's...
I know. So would you like to introduce yourself just for the benefit of anyone who doesn't know who you are?
Yeah, I'm Harry Robinson. I work at the Lotus Eaters and I produce videos for them. I write articles for them. I appear on the Daily Podcast, which is the podcast of the Lotus Eaters. I'm not on every episode, but I tend to be one of the more frequent people appearing on that, where we cover, you know, daily news, go over the news cycle. I try and inject a little bit more sometimes than just going over the news cycle. And for something as... forward-facing, as public-facing as the podcast, I occasionally try and skirt the line of what's acceptable. But I think that that's useful. I think that that's more useful sometimes than just going over, can you believe what's been going on with the left today? Because I will be perfectly honest, I find that personally somewhat tiring. After all of this time, I've been there for over 2 years now. So I try and inject a little bit more, a little bit more substance to it than you would expect for just a daily podcast. You know, if you want to watch Tim Pool, who I'm sure is a lovely fellow, getting angry and shouting at headlines, then you can do that. But I like to try to make my segments that I do for it a little bit more substantial than that.
Yeah, there is always this danger of getting lost in the everyday, the churn of events. And I think there are people who are optimized for that. There are people like Styx Hexenhammer, for example, who has always done that, and he's very good at it. He's like a news source, just constantly giving you a report of what's happened. But then I think there are other people who much more prefer in-depth, talking about the abstractions, the principles, the mechanisms at work, both ideological and historical. Because it's interesting to see how this situation has evolved. Where did it come from? And in your notes for this, you said that you were, the 20th century. The 20th century, I remember at the very end of it, there was the Pet Shop Boys, who I don't really like that much. But they did this album and there was one song on it called The 20th Century. And I thought at the time, I was like 18 or whatever, I thought that was interesting because it started with this very sort of abstract sound. And I remember thinking, yeah, because the 20th century is very mysterious. And we've got this notion of it in our heads from the media. But I don't think, well... you can guess where I'm going. I mean, I think that there's a simplified and rather distorted version of the 20th century that is told in retrospect. And perhaps that happens with everything. And there is a mainstream view of the 20th century, which is like the age of democracy and human rights, overcoming empire and bigotry and so forth. But there's another view, which I think it comes into focus with COVID and with the subsequent events in the last 20 years. So anyway, basically what you said in your notes was that there's a need to revise our history of the 20th century. That's what I'm getting to. So would you like to take up that baton just to describe what you mean by that?
Yeah, absolutely. So For me, looking back at the 20th century, you obviously have a greater perspective on that. I don't know exactly how old you are, but you said, you know, later on in the 20th century, you're 18, 19. The oldest I ever was in the 20th century proper was about 3 years old. I was born in 1996. So for me, the 20th century has always been something that to retrospectively look back onto, and that has been something in the rearview mirror. And for a long time, I grew up in the paradigm that we're all fed from primary school here in England, that the 20th century was this great time of social progress where everyone just became much more tolerant and loving of one another. Everybody started to learn that, you know, differences between people just don't exist if you don't believe that they don't exist. If we all just stop thinking about differences between people, we can all hold hands across the world and sing Kumbaya together. And that started after we defeated the Nazis. And then in the 1950s, we were still slipping a little bit because there was still bigotry and segregation in the southern states of America. But then civil rights came along, and then gay rights came along. And then all of that happened, and now we're living in the perfect social utopia. And as a young man, as a teenager, you know, there were parts of it that didn't really sit right with me, but I accepted because it was the easiest thing to do. Is the easiest thing to do socially is to go along with everything. And you grow up in a particular paradigm, so you're not taught to be able to tell things apart from one another. But it was just for me the process of saying certain things out loud. Like the idea that in any war there is a distinct and easily noticed and easily dividable good guys and bad guys, and all of the good guys do all of the good things and all of the bad guys do all of the bad things. And then it was only really with a few years ago when I started to have my political awakening and started to actually read things, you know, somewhat cringeworthy, but it is true. I was inaugurated through the Jordan Peterson pipeline because I had encounters with SJWs and such like that before and always found them really cringe. But then through that, I found Jordan Peterson, and then he kept recommending Gulag Archipelago. You got to read the Gulag Archipelago. Obviously, he's not going to recommend many of other Solzhenitsyn's other books, but Gulag Archipelago is the one that he always goes on about. So I got a copy of that, and I started reading through this. And my first thought reading through this was, but I was told that these were the guys that we sided with. I was told that these were the good guys. I was told that... And then actually the good guys, like Churchill took all of these guys, these people who were trying to get refuge away from the Soviet Union when they sided with them, and they knew that the Soviet Union was this horrible repressive regime that was torturing all of these people, sending hundreds of thousands to the gulags. And Churchill and the other Allied leaders just sent them back, even though they knew what was going to happen to them when they got back. And I thought, that's not what a good guy would do. That's a really strange thing for the good guys to do.
Very. And so you start to realize, well, actually, it's not about good and evil. It's much more murky and complicated than that.
Absolutely.
And the good and evil thing is a cartoonish notion that has been given to the masses.
Yeah, we get sold the Saturday morning villain cartoon history of the 20th century. And that's in every aspect, all the way from the beginning of the 20th century to the end of the 20th century. And I think it's important because I've been wondering a lot, and I've been seeing a lot of discourse on this recently, particularly AA recently hosted a debate between Scrump and Evelyn and Charlemagne and Ryan Turnipseed, where they were talking about, is the right too negative? Is the online right too negative? Because, you know, I don't particularly see Millais and people like that as that much of a win. Oh, great, we get an insane libertarian to come in and tear up the last bits of social cohesion so he can open it all up to the free market. Absolutely wonderful. I can't wait to see what's going to happen. Oh, and he's a massive Zionist as well. Brilliant. This is going to be incredible. I can't wait. But I don't see those as victories. Scrump and Evelyn don't seem to see those as victories either. But is it too negative? And it's got me thinking, what is the purpose of the online right? What are we all here for? Are we just pissing in the wind? Are we here so that we can talk around and round and round in circles and cheer on the victories of other people and enact schadenfreude against the left? I mean, that's all fun. That's all well and good. It's nice to point that the loony left have lost their marbles yet again. But we've got to be aiming for something a bit more than that. And I think one of the best and most preliminary things that we can do, the first step, is to organize our own narrative as to how we got into the social positions that we are in right now. How is it that the world changed from the early 20th century? And I've recently read through Peter Hitchens' A Brief History of Crime. And I think reading through works like that is one of the easiest ways that you can get a good perspective on it. Just reading the raw numbers of crime statistics in Britain between then and now to see how much things have degenerated.
Yeah, Scrump and Evelyn actually did a stream about that, I think a couple of weeks ago that I watched, where they went into...
I think it was last week.
Well, last week, yeah. Yeah. This has been a bit of a maelstrom for me. but yeah,
I bet.
Recent. And they went into that and they said that it's unimaginably higher with each decade. They wouldn't have been able to imagine how much worse the crime would be 20 years from now, 40 years from now, and so on. And yeah, it's staggering. And also, this is an interesting point, it predates the era of mass immigration. So in the first 40, 50 years of the 20th century, it was going up all the time. So it's not just about incompatible peoples or lack of integration or whatever. It's even within the British themselves. There was a breakdown of, what would you say, social cohesion, morality, something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. The interesting thing, I think they had the numbers. I don't know the exact numbers off the top of my head, but it was something unimaginably low. Unimaginably low, like in the earlier, I think in 1909, the crime rate across all of England and Wales, and this is all crime, was something as ridiculously low as 19,000 in a single year. And you would probably find boroughs of London now that can surpass that in a few months, because we have that much crime. It is so exponential. And so the question that we need to ask ourselves is, how did we get here? How did we get here? Because if we really did experience the utopia of social progress between now and then, why have things got worse? Why is it that I can walk down the street and feel less safe than I could even 10 years ago walking around similar streets? And I moved from Cheshire to Swindon, but I'm told by reliable sources that Swindon, as much as I dislike it now, was not always this bad. So even in the past few years, things keep speeding up, things keep getting worse. And the whole paradigm that we exist under right now is underpinned by those myths of the 20th century, of the progress that we supposedly felt, that we supposedly experienced. And like you say, it's not just mass immigration, but mass immigration has been one of those things that's added to how exponential the increase has been. There's another book. It's a License to Kill, something like that. It's a book from 2013, 2014 about violent crime in England and how much worse it's got over the years. And there's a graph in that which shows that between, I think it's 1995 and 2005, the rate of violent crime basically doubled. And obviously that coincides with the era of mass immigration being brought in by Blair. So that does account for recent violence. Yeah,
there are some trends where they coincide so much that it's not a coincidence.
Oh, but correlation doesn't equal causation. Correlation doesn't equal causation. Yeah. But you're right that it was happening before mass immigration, before even the Windrush generation came along as well. And it is because, for whatever reason, the elites in Britain, it seems, just entirely relinquished any responsibility they had for properly steering the country in the right direction. They just decided, for some reason, that we don't like what came before us. And from what research I've done so far, it does seem that this was something that was probably brewing in the late 19th century as well. Like, I've been reading, because one of the reasons I've been into revisionism recently is I've decided, I think one of the big narratives that was sold is about the history of gay rights in the latter half of the 20th century. We're told it's basically the same as civil rights, which is also a lie, as the narrative, which is that grassroots movements and groups popped up because they were tired of being oppressed, and they just enacted democracy hard enough at the ruling elites, and the ruling elites were convinced by the marketplace of ideas, the free expression that these people threw at them, forced these leaders to
enact new laws. Power. They spoke truth to power enough that change happened.
and it's rubbish. It's obvious. It's like, once again, it's Saturday morning cartoon villain stuff that the conservatives in charge were just grumpy old meanies who just didn't feel like being nice to the gays. But that's one of the things that's got me really interested in it, because as part of that, I've been reading up some of Ed Dutton's work on his book Spiteful Mutants, which goes into some of the stuff regarding the private school culture of Britain, the boarding school, the Etonian kind of culture in the latter 19th century. And it sounds to me, personally, from what he says there, like a lot of those people who would later end up running in Parliament were getting buggered by each other and by the headmasters and other such things, which isn't going to, I don't know if that's going to be great for ushering in a generation of well-adjusted elites.
And then there was literally the thing fagging. It's a coincidence that it's got the same name, but I think fagging was when an older boy would have a younger boy as a kind of servant kind of thing. I can't remember. It's just a coincidence, but with the word. But the thing about I used to have this great nostalgia for Victorian England and the British private school, boarding school tradition. I was always a bit envious that I didn't have something like that myself. But as time passes, I start to, and I think everyone has some affection. Like, this is why one of the reasons Harry Potter is successful and popular with people. They've got this romance about a tradition, and it's cozy and all that. But as time passes, I start to think, you know, these boarding schools, if you wanted to really mess a child up, it just seems like a recipe for it, for ending up with a maladjusted adult who can't really. And I'm sure this is what I'm saying is cartoonish. I'm sure there were loads of guys who came out of that perfectly fine. But I don't really know how, because it seems like a recipe for screwing them up. Obviously, the buggering, the intimidation that would accompany that, the bullying, the detachment from your parents, feelings of abandonment. I know a guy who went to boarding school and recently, and he had that. And one of the most traumatic experiences of his life was when he first went there and he was begging his parents not to abandon him. That must have happened for loads of boys throughout the ages, and especially in the 19th century. And then you've got the extreme discipline within the school itself. The rigor of the education. Now, I don't doubt the quality of the education at all, but I'm skeptical about the culture of the schools, everything that I've just listed. If you then end up with these people going into politics and all the positions of authority in society, it's not surprising if they're going to be a bit maladjusted just on the basis of their education alone.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you say, I'm sure that there are plenty of people who came out of that just fine, who didn't have bad things happen to them. But from what we do know, it's no surprise that some of our leaders later ended up completely relinquishing any attachment that they had to the culture. And in some cases, attaching themselves to foreign cultures and valorizing foreign cultures and putting the priorities of foreign cultures above their own because they had a more pleasant and positive view of them in comparison to what they presumably assumed British Christian culture to be. And this seems to be something that was happening a lot across all of Europe. One of the big focuses that I wasn't expecting to take on when I've been doing the research for this, but which has become somewhat of a focus for me, was Germany. And everyone knows about Weimar Germany, especially Berlin being this really degenerate place. We've all heard the stories about child prostitution going on there. You may have heard the story. There's one where apparently there was a goose, and they would engage in some kind of crowds of people would engage in an orgy where they would cut a goose's throat or something like that. Absolutely vile, disgusting stuff. But one of the things that's important is that that didn't happen overnight, because one of the things that we've always got to take into account is that the present moment has not just sprung into existence completely out of nowhere. There's a context, and human action has led us to where we are. And one of the things that was in the latter half of the 19th century, Berlin, because it grew so much as a city, it seems that all major urban areas that turn into cities that have exploding populations, I think in the course of 20, 30 years, the population went from 400,000 to 5 million people. So you're able to get a big anonymous culture you never could in a small village or a smaller town where most people know each other. There's a much more greater level of social control in those smaller settings because everybody can keep tabs. But when you're lost in the anonymity of a city, all sorts of strange things can start happening. And what started happening was a load of gay cafes and gay bars started to pop up. And at first, the police tried to get a handle on these. But after one or two shutdowns of these places and noticing they would just pop up elsewhere, they just took their hands off the steering wheel and decided that they were going to start letting this happen. And in particular, the police chief at the time, I think his name was Hullesum, and I've got all this from reading an interesting book called Gay Berlin. And the author of that book is very much in favor of everything that went on back there. And it talks a lot about Magnus Hirschfeld and obviously what happened to Hirschfeld and his institute by the time that the Nazis came into power is the worst thing that ever happened. And put a brakes on progress for a little bit, and it should never have happened. So he's all in favor of that. But one of the good things about reading leftist books is they don't sugarcoat any of the details because they're proud of it. They're really happy. They're really happy that all of this happened. So they're bragging about it. Can you believe that all the way back in the early 1900s, in 1909, 1910, 1920, the first transsexual surgeries were being performed where they were removing the testicles from the ball sack and then just, you know, doing all sorts of disgusting things with nowhere near the same kind of medical expertise that we have these days. So all manner of mistakes were going on.
Yeah.
They like to throw these in as these were stepping stones. Mistakes were made.
Someone was telling me about this a few weeks ago, and I thought, given how crude the surgery is nowadays, I mean, it's unimaginable what it must have been like
barbaric.
In 1920. It doesn't bear thinking about.
Yeah, it must have been like stepping into a medieval dungeon to go into those surgery practices. It's ridiculous and disgusting to think about. Thankfully, the photo section doesn't include anything like photos from the surgery table. But he talks about all of this in there. And this police chief, Hullesum, he decided that he was going to, as long as these people were just gathering in their own places, in their own bars and cafes, and they weren't causing any big trouble outside of those, then that's absolutely fine. I'm just not going to deal with it. If they start to, you know, display public sex acts, then I'll have to step in because they had a law, paragraph 175 in the German Republic about it, unified Germany. But we're going to leave them be. We're going to leave them to it. But what this ended up doing was allowing so that all of these places could form actors, informal gathering places for these people. And what happens when you get a minority of people who are allowed a certain level of privacy in a physical space so that they can all gather? Well, they're going to start organizing. They're going to start organizing their activism. And so, like we
You're
see
essentially
today,
incubating a problem there.
Yes, and it was even worse than that because he basically gave tacit approval because they would have what I have labeled in my notes as homo balls, where all of the gay community of Berlin at the time, which included a wide range of figures all the way up to the aristocracy, would gather for these masked balls where, and this is in like the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, so way earlier than you would expect, they would hire out some of the biggest venues in Berlin at the time and have gay balls together where the police chief would attend and bring tourists from Paris and London to show off the culture. He didn't approve of it. He was doing it for some kind of curiosity tourism. But this was still something you give the people basic approval by saying, I'm the police chief, but I'm not actually going to do anything about it. In fact, I'll show you off as a circus curiosity. That empowers people to know that they can get away with things. So like the way today, obviously it's a different circumstance, a different set of contingencies, but like the way today that we know that there are all manner of crimes that you can get away with if you have a particular identity attached to you, because the police just won't investigate you. The police will actively know what you're doing, and they will get and they won't do anything about it. Means that you have a lot of power to organize politically behind the scenes, and you have a lot of power to get away with doing all sorts of immoral things that legally are prescribed, de jure they're prescribed, but de facto it's completely illegal. So it's interesting how it always seems to be, and this is one of the interesting things about learning history, because once again, being a product of the 21st century primary schooling system, my knowledge of history up until I started reading about it a few years ago was not very well developed, because that's one of the tricks that they do is they only teach you very modular, regimented history. You learn about maybe Henry VIII. No, you definitely learn about Henry VIII because you need to know that he was very nasty to his wives. And that's the only thing that you learn about him there. Did you know he had eight wives? He chopped a few of their heads off. Not a very nice man. And that's you learn about him.
I know exactly what you mean, because I've said the same thing about my own history education, that they teach you about some isolated moments, but there's absolutely, you leave it with absolutely no sense of how these things link together. There's no sense of a continuum. And I think that's terrible. It would be better to, I don't know, I mean, you've got to tailor education for different types of people, but I think it would be better to know almost nothing about each era, but to know how they link together. Because at least then you have a sense people, of history.
Yeah, you're leaving people completely untethered from the past. And if they have no idea of what came before them, because De Maistre has a fantastic little phrase where he describes history is experimental philosophy. There are no new ideas under the sun. Everything has been tried before. In history, you can always refer back to it to tell you how that went. Okay, you want communism? Well, let's go look back and see how that worked. But if you don't actually have any knowledge of that, if everything is completely new to you, if you're not playing the hatchling, like Morgoth says, if you're an actual hatchling and the world is perfectly new to you, you've got no self-defense mechanism. You've got no way of understanding anything within context. So that's what I got. I got Henry VIII, a bit of the Civil War, World War II, definitely got World War II, the Holocaust, and then civil rights. And even at the time, I remember thinking, I'm English in an English school. Why am I learning about this thing that happened over the pond in America? That's a very strange thing. But it's targeted. It's targeted because they're feeding you this narrative. They're feeding you the way of seeing the world. It's the same way that the media programs you, because I think education and media, they go absolutely hand in hand. All of these things, these television programs, these shit films that we get fed, they all reinforce the same narratives. It's how when I was working in a bar a few years ago, the manager of the bar could say, without even thinking twice about it, having never been to America, that all Texans are racist bigots. And I said, you've never been there. How do you know that? And she goes, well, they all are, aren't they? And I didn't realize at the time, but it's very clear that, oh, she watched television and they put the Southern accent on the bigoted racist idiots, and yeah, she assumed from there, because it programs
exactly.
You.
The toothless redneck who knows nothing, obviously is a Bible-bashing Christian, and beats his wife, of course. And
I watched A Time to Kill. That was an honest story.
Holy shit. Yeah, there was a stream that Frode Midyard did with
American Krogan, yeah.
American Krogan, and they've obviously seen it. I thought that was a tremendous stream. I don't have the link now, but people should go to Frode's channel and look for it, because it was a brilliant, brilliant stream, brilliant piece of work. And they analysed the film and the reality that it was based upon, and the novel that it was based on, and then the reality. And it's amazing. It's just incredible how much it was distorted, and something was repurposed, 180 degrees, really. Quite incredible.
Yeah, I believe it was a couple of black guys, you know, did awful things to a young white girl and then murdered her, and then got put in prison for it. Pretty simple story. Horrible things happened. The right people got punished. It should never have happened in the first place, should never have had the chance to happen, but justice was administered. The filmmakers turn around and say, you know what? We need to make them racist rednecks, and it happens to a black girl instead. because they don't care about the truth. They don't care that this is an actual story of somebody suffering. They just care about pushing the narrative. It's the same. I've seen there's another case of Netflix casting that's come out recently, actually. I've seen where who was it? There was a big legal expose. I've seen people posting about it on Twitter where a white man and a white woman were the lawyers who uncovered the story and then brought legal action against it and solved the problem. And they actually brought some good legal challenges to a big company or something like that. And in Netflix, they've gone, I mean, that's a great story, but it'd be a lot better if she was a black woman with dreadlocks.
Yeah. Hence all the memes about Netflix. I won't show any on screen, but I do have a large collection of these where they've changed some historical figure, made them black or whatever. It's ridiculous. And Disney are doing it now as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people act like it's a new thing. And that's one of the things that's being untethered from history. You look at a film like Time to Kill, and that's what, from the early 90s? For most people of my generation who weren't born then, they'll go, okay, I guess that's actually, oh, it's based on a true story. I guess that's what actually happened then. Oh, but now I see that Netflix is doing this. Can you believe what we need to do is we need to get, it creates that false paradigm where they go, we need to get back to the 90s when everything was sensible and everybody got along with each other, not recognizing that the story they were told about the 90s was a lie as well. The 90s had some of, this is probably the video I'm proudest of that I did for the Lotus Eaters was an analysis of American History X and the Rodney King race riots that happened back in, I think it was 1992, because, you know, I watched that film as a teenager a few times and I thought, I really like this. So earlier on at the beginning of the year, I thought, you know, I'm going to rewatch this. And I watched it and I said to myself, okay, that film was not what I thought it was. It was another piece of propaganda because it presents you with this reprehensible, despicable Nazi, Ed Norton's Nazi, who you're supposed to hate. Everything that comes out of his mouth is bile. He's so racist and evil. He hates the Jews. So everything that he says is supposed to be some veiled form of racism. And then at the dinner table scene, you've probably seen the film, right?
A long time ago, I remember what you're talking about, and I've seen the dinner scene subsequently, yeah.
Yeah, there's the dinner table scene where he starts going on about Rodney King, and he starts making arguments that I knew were true and had read in Rothbard, because Rothbard is actually early 90s Rothbard is really good for this stuff, because he doesn't hold back, he lets loose on all the stuff that he doesn't hold back his opinions on anything in that. But I knew from Rothbard that the Rodney King story was not true the way that they were presenting it, and that in fact Rodney King was a criminal, it's very similar to George Floyd. He was a criminal. He was driving drunk and high, led the police on a high speed chase for almost an hour, pulled over, and then didn't cooperate with the police. So this guy was enormous. He was high. Well, they had to do something to prevent him from being able to escape. And interestingly enough, in the trial that went on afterwards, they said to the police, one of the police officers who did it, they asked him when he was on the stand, they said, why didn't you choke the guy out? I mean, that would have stopped the problem immediately. You wouldn't have to beat him. Then you would be able to make more of a plausible argument that you didn't go above what was necessary. And he said, well, I didn't do that because with the LAPD, choking black guys out is associated with murdering them. So I wanted to do the thing that would get me in less trouble. I wasn't expecting to get this all caught on camera. Except American History X was portraying that through the mouth of the Nazi, where all of the rest of the people at the dinner table who are supposed to be the audience stand-ins are going, oh, I can't believe he would say that. So one of the ways that's programming you, and I said this in the video, was that it's supposed to trick you into thinking that your conservative uncle, who says things that are actually very reasonable and sound like they could be true, is actually a hidden Nazi, and you should react to him as if he was just telling you that you need to gas the Jews.
Yeah, it's about associations. So even if what he said, don't even worry whether what he says is true or not. Just remember that it sounds similar to what this Nazi said. And that's really the only thing you need to worry about. That means that he is a Nazi or as good as a Nazi. So there's no real argumentation. It's just tinkering around with the associations in your head to change the way you think about that and the way that you will receive things in the future. It's conditioning. And I think, it was either American History X or there was another film from the same era It wasn't America. It was a different one, but I can't remember what it was. And the main character actually says this. He actually says the trick that they use, where they'll have some truth, but they'll have it delivered by a horrible character. So that then you'll associate that with some shitty character.
That's interesting. That's interesting, yeah. That they would actually say that. But I bet the character who said that, I bet he was supposed to be the bad guy. So you're supposed to think that, well, in that case, why would Hollywood producers lie to me? What would Hollywood have to gain from lying to me about anything?
Exactly. Why would the Chi-Coms lie? Well, I think this is, I mean, this is very interesting because I've been doing my own, a similar project to well, not, I don't think we're going to overlap, but it's similar in the sense that it's about the loony left in the 80s in Britain. And, you know, research is actually fascinating. I don't know if you've found this. I find it very enjoyable.
I love reading through books and just learning new things. I think one of the things that you've got to do if you're going to engage in this kind of work is learn to love learning new things. That's what you've got to do. Thankfully, I've always been somebody who's been eager to expand my knowledge and improve myself. So it comes quite easily to me. But if you want to do useful work, that's what you got to do.
Yeah. And it's interesting. It's fun because it means that you don't have to just rant the stuff that you already know and the stuff that you already believe. It can actually be a learning experience for you. That sounds quite self-righteous, but it's the truth. It you know, there are several essays that I've written on Substack this year that I wouldn't have done them. It wouldn't have occurred to me, like the one about Scottish hospital food, for example. That happened because I started learning about the matter. Well, literally. And it turned out to be interesting. So, and then that led to various others and ultimately to the Loony Left project, which is a huge thing. And the relevance to your own project is that what you find is that things didn't happen the way you've been told they happened. Things happened sooner or later than you've been told, that you've been led to believe. And so that changes everything. That means that the rhythm of history is different from the one that you've been told. There is so much to learn because there has been so much distortion and so much simplification of the way things actually happened, misrepresentation. I find it fascinating. And I think that for us, what is the online right for? I think at least one of the things it's for and can do and really should do is exactly this resorting of the historiography of the 20th century and the 19th century, you know, other areas as well, but clearly the 20th century, because it hasn't been digested yet, at least not by people who I think are very truthful. There's been the, liberal left account, and those are the people who obviously populate academia. So it's their version that we're now hearing, and that the young are now being told, and that the people who watch TV are now being told. One of the crucial things that, and actually valuable things that we can do, is come up with a different account that I think is simply more honest, more truthful than the one that everyone knows already.
Yeah, absolutely. And plus, there is also the thought that if you're going to embody an elite has to know that when the time comes that they'll win. This is something that AA always goes on about. You need to manifest it. You need to embody the mindset of the elite. And so the thought is, well, when we win, what are we going to teach people? Because there's a hell of a lot in the institutions right now, the educational institutions in particular, that in the media institutions as well, which is a lie, which is an outright distortion of the truth. So we need to have our narrative, we need to have our historiography in line so that we are able to replace it with something. And like you say, the good thing about what we're doing is that what we're replacing it with is not just a false narrative. It's honest. It's what actually went down. And one of the other things, I'm really interested in your Loony Left in the 80s thing, by the way, because I was listening earlier on today to AA's stream that he did about Thatcher's Americanization of England.
I as well, yeah.
That, and that was really good because the Loony Left seemed to play not so big a part in all of that. A lot of the elements of societal breakdown that were created through the 80s and further into the 90s under John Major that led to Blair were put in by ostensibly what some, what I'm sure some, the normie cons would say is, oh, based Maggie Thatcher, the most right-wing leader we've had in decades.
And the left would say that she was a hardcore, like hard right traditionalist.
Oh, she's basically fascist at this
point. Yeah, exactly. I mean, well, by today's standards, she was a fascist. I mean, you know, she said that people don't have a right to be gay. You know, that, by today's standards,
I was going to university from 2016 onwards and doing a media course like I did, the amount of people in my classes who, for every film project, every media project that we did, decided that they wanted to do a documentary on Section 28 from the 1980s. Don't you know, Maggie Thatcher wanted to stop people from being taught about gay people in the 1980s. It was an obsession, but it was also an obsession because they knew it got brownie points from the lecturers. All of the lecturers believed all this. I mean, when it was time for Brexit, one of the heads of the university that I was going to was going around all the classes because she knew that we were all at least 18, old enough to vote, saying, you best vote Remain, you best make sure to vote Remain. So all of the teachers, they were all massive leftists. So if you made something about Section 28, they were going to give you a better mark for it. But then also, all of the people, they didn't need that incentive because they were already massive leftists who were obsessed with it. They were pathological with it. They wouldn't shut the fuck up about Section 28.
And they seem to think that it's crucial, that they need to do that. Not just that it'll get me brownie points, but it's a very valid social issue. Section 28.
Because they see it as recurring now. They see the Tories saying that, hey, maybe we should slow down, not stop, but maybe we should slow down a bit on the queering of all of the school education and everything. They see that as the same thing as Section 28.
And yeah, again, this comes up in, I've encountered this in the Looney Left research. There was actually a politician, I was reading Hansard's reports, from the late, I think it was 88 or 87. And there was this politician who said in the House of Commons, something like, do we really want homosexuals teaching children?
That's a good question.
Yeah. And I mean, the thing is, can you imagine someone saying that in the House of Commons now? I mean, that.
Oh, they'd get jeered out.
Unthinkable. But it was
Sunak would embarrassingly personally escort them out.
Yes. And at the time, it was, I think it was Jack Straw who replied to I can't remember who the guy was, but the person who replied to him, I'm pretty sure it was Jack Straw, and he said, why ever not? Now, why would you not want a homosexual teaching your child? And it's just interesting that it was Jack Straw, because it was someone who then became prominent in New Labour 10 years later. And of course, he transformed the country in various ways. But yeah, there's so much to this. And this is why it's fascinating. And this is what I discovered when I started. I thought it was going to just be a normal essay, like of my Substack stuff, like 3,000 words. But it the more I researched, the more I found that there are more avenues and more avenues, more things to discuss, because it's a whole thing. Feminism, race, obviously gay. The trans thing wasn't there yet, and it wasn't even there in the late 90s. That's actually been really left on the back burner for a long time. But it was all these different issues, and it was a version that we would now, it very much echoed what we now call wokery today, 40 years later. That's what's so interesting about it to me. It's ideas that are now mainstream that back then were shocking to the public. And that's why it didn't work. That's why it was called the Looney Left. But then that enables the right to become complacent, because they've labelled it loony, they've mocked it, so now it'll surely just go away, right? But no, not at all.
We can just laugh them out of the room, but they don't get the joke, and they don't care if you're laughing at them, because they're the ones in power.
Exactly. And another, interesting sequel to this project would be to talk about the 90s. How is it that these ideas were completely rejected in the 80s and and they were very amateurish then, very crude. And then in the 90s, it was big conferences, international conferences talking about race and diversity in the media and so forth. How did that trans? And I mean, the short answer is big money got involved and pumped resources into this. But
that seems to be the case from what I've been seeing as well. And also, with big money comes big marketing firms and PR and the media class as well getting involved in it. Like, one of the things that I learned is that in the 70s and 80s, no surprise to anybody who's read up on Pi at all, is that there's a reason that the gay rights movement was so heavily associated in people's minds with paedophiles, is because a lot of the time these two did make common cause with one another. And within the gay rights movement, there was always a sizable enough chunk that was very against it because they knew it was bad press. But for the most part, they did align very well with one another. One of the guys in the American scene, I think his name was David Thorstadt, his name is. He's got an entire paper talking about this, and he was one of the founders of NAMBLA. So a truly despicable character, but a very good journalist and writer. And he's got a 30-page essay discussing NAMBLA's connection with the American gay rights movement, going all the way back to the 1960s around Stonewall, when all of those organizations started to form in the late 1960s. But what happened in the early 90s is that the people in charge of these movements, getting associated with big money and big corporations, realized we can't have this bad press. So they purged all of them. All of these people, similar to how the Corbynites have recently been purged by Keir Starmer, you have these people in the movement so that you can have a critical mass to show up for demonstrations and other such things. But then when you actually start to get near the levers of power, that's when you purge them.
Yeah, because they become a liability.
Yeah, so, because they make you look bad.
Yeah, and it was the same thing in the late 80s. This is how the Loony Left ended, because Neil Kinnock was besieged on... three fronts, by Thatcher and the Tories, by the loony left, that's the sort of radical new left, but also the radical old left, which was communists. So this is why Kinnock, I mean, he really endured a lot. And this is why I think he didn't really achieve anything as leader of the Labour Party, because he was entirely on the defensive throughout most of his time. And anyway, he really sort of ousted them and disgraced them in 87, and that was when it was over, really. And thereafter, you start to see it evolving into what we emerged as New Labour. But yeah, they basically got rid of these wild people. That's the point.
Yeah, and I just want to focus just for a brief moment, because it's on my mind, which is that point that you made about Jack Straw responding to the why would you want homosexuals teaching your kids? Well, why wouldn't you? That is the libertarian, libertine attitude. The why does it bother you, bro? Why do you care, bro? Is one of the most grating things in the world, because it's not just something that's unique to the left anymore. It's often repeated by the more libertarian right. And I don't know if I even consider these people to be on the right. I went through a libertarian phase. I think a lot of people in this sphere do go through a libertarian phase.
I'll confess to the same, yes.
Yeah, if you read the right people when you're going through that phase, though, if you read latter-era Rothbard, if you read Hopper, you end up getting some of the better ideas from it that allow you, I think, to make it more useful, and you're able to turn it into a learning experience where you get a better idea of how power works, reading from people who view it from an abstract notion and from the outside as well. And you're able to move on to more useful things. But this whole idea of the why do you care? How does this affect you personally? Is something that I have been confronted with. And I'm going to vent my spleen very briefly, if you don't mind.
Go for it. I'll show a selection of libertarian memes while you rant.
Oh, absolutely, please. Which is that recently you may have seen that Michael Knowles did an interview for the Daily Wire with Arden Young, who has done an expose on the writers and executives, the producers at the MindGeek, now ALO, the guys who own Pornhub. talking about an expose of how these people are actively putting gay and trans themes into the pornography, so that they're and trying to push this stuff, recommend it, tune the algorithms on these websites like Pornhub to try and encourage straight people to watch this stuff and then it ends up malforming their opinions. That's a very good one as well. So it ends up malforming their sexual preferences because these people know, and I think it is truth, that for a lot of people, sexuality can be quite malleable. And that's the interesting thing about it. You desensitize yourself to really degenerate things on the internet, and it ends up malforming your brain. You know, there's the very clear pipeline of the coma to truning, which happens to quite a few people. Sadly, it's happened to a few people that I've known. But I did a segment on that that went up on YouTube earlier on today. And my God, the fucking libertarians showing up in the comments and going, "What, so you want to ban porn then?" Yes. Yes, I would happily. I would happily ban pornography. Because I did a section at the end of it where I just talked about how it can change the way the dopamine receptors in your brain react. There's lots of scientific research showing that it makes you dependent on it like a highly addicted drug, and it leads to you getting desensitized to it, so you indulge in the more degenerate stuff, yada, yada, yada. Everybody should know about this by now. But then you have people showing up in the comments, and somebody said, very sensibly, if the founding fathers had known that ideas of free speech, because you know organizations like the ACLU are always eager to throw in a lawsuit saying this is unconstitutional, banning children watching porn is unconstitutional, say the ACLU. Okay. Saying if the founding fathers knew that their ideas of free speech could get, you know, all this, they'd have made a few amendments to it to make sure that this explicitly wouldn't happen. And then you get libertarian retards showing up saying, well, if the founding fathers knew AR-15s would exist in the future, they wouldn't have written the Second Amendment. You're using the same logic as this stupid line. That's right. I came up with an absurd scenario in my head and said, my retarded libertarian principles say that these are the two exact same things. Therefore, porn should be fine even when we know that the websites trafficking this stuff are using sex traffic victims and have been more than happy until they get legal challenges against them to host rape videos on their website. It frustrates me. It frustrates me so much. And then you get the same person showing up again and again and again in these doing the classic like, oh, but this is free speech. Pornography is free speech. Duh. No, it's not.
That's a ridiculous thing to say. And I understand the logic, but it's just in reality, it's just not true.
No, it's absolutely not. I mean, you could say porn is political, and I would say, yes, it can be, but it's used in a political way to desensitize the population and act as a form of social and mind control. That's clearly what it is for. That's why it's so easy to get hold of it. That's why these people who run these companies know that it's 11 and 12-year-olds watching their content and explicitly say in these videos that they're tailoring their content for that demographic. But then you get retards going like, no, but if we ban the pornography, they'll be taking off free speech next. If you ban the pornography, this is just like Count Dankula getting in trouble for the Nazi pug video. Like, in what value system are these two things the same? If this is what your value system leads you to, is defending these websites, then what is the point of the value system that you hold? What is it defending other than your right to coom 24/7? Yeah. Sorry, I needed to get that off my mind.
Oh, that's fine. I completely agree. And you know, you've only got to think back to 100 years ago, or even less than that, when we had free speech, but we didn't have widespread pornography. And it was prescribed, prohibited, limited in various ways. I mean, it wasn't, obviously the availability channels weren't there that exist now. But nonetheless, it wasn't, in every newsagent or whatever. It was very much something that was held back. Even though we did have virtually complete freedom of speech, far more freedom of speech than we actually have now.
So it's
a false dichotomy.
But that's how insidious it's been that these, what I consider to be very leftist opinions, are now spouted by those who say that they're on the right, because there are some parts of the libertarian right, I mean, I suppose that's what makes them libertarian, that have taken it that liberty, and this is a completely free of restrictions liberty, where nothing is ever prescribed. There's the classic, every man is free to destroy himself in whatever way he may please. This idea is somehow associated with the right wing. In no understanding of the ancient regime prior to the French Revolution would this ever be associated with anything other than the most radical form of social organization you've ever heard. Because that's not social organization, that's social destruction in a sentence. Your entire philosophy is, as long as it doesn't affect me personally, I don't care if Western civilization falls, then congratulations, you've handed your enemies the key to victory.
Absolutely. You're not protecting your society from any manner of attacks on it that can be launched by someone who wants to destroy you and your people. So, yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that, you know, I am definitely pro freedom of speech, but I do think that gore and sex should be censored. I mean, I don't mind the BBFC existing. I used to when I was an adolescent, but I used to believe that it was the same thing, freedom of speech, freedom of media. But now I think, no, there
freedom
should be
of vice, I think, is what a lot of people are actually arguing for.
Freedom of vice.
Yeah, I think that's what a lot of people are arguing for when they trot out freedom of expression. What they mean is freedom of vice. And mentioning the BBFC, it was interesting that this was another thing that I can tie back into the historical revisionism. Do you watch Proper Horror Show?
No, I haven't heard of it, in fact.
Oh, well, it's a woman called Chloe. She's absolutely lovely. She's somewhat connected to the spheres. I've appeared on a few of her streams. It's just horror film analysis. She's got
Sorry to interrupt, but is that based on A Clockwork Orange Nadsat? Does he not say something's Proper Horror Show? I think it might be from
To my eternal shame, I have not watched A Clockwork Orange in full. And so I'm sorry. That might have broken a few hearts out there.
It's fine. I haven't seen The Godfather.
Have you actually not?
No, I haven't.
Oh, fair play. Well, but she does these streams. I've appeared on it a few times. She appeared on Lotus Eaters with me a month or two ago, and we spoke about the history of the BBFC, because it's interesting, because it acts as a small microcosm case study of everything that we're talking about. Because if you go on the BBFC's website, it's interesting how much they had mission creep, because originally they weren't even supposed to be organizing the censorship of the films. They were just there to make sure that cinemas were storing their film reels properly and health and safety was being kept to, so that the cinemas didn't burn down. It's really interesting. But then as time went on, they got more and more mission creep and they began censoring the films, and they became basically an unofficial arm of the government, because technically they're still an NGO. But they're just an NGO that everybody abides by, including the cinema chains. But when you look through their history, after the 1950s, as with everything, after the mid-1940s onwards, they begin to liberalize. And this comes with different change in personnel, where in the late 1950s, I think you get a man called Trevelyan, who starts to run it, and he starts to liberalize it, but only up to a point, because we can liberalize it, but only up to the point where common sense says that's silly. And then the next guy comes along and says, well, I think where you said the line was, I think that was a bit repressive, so we're going to push it a little bit more. Keeps happening and keeps happening. And the way that they justify it on the website is that they keep appealing to democracy, appealing to false democracy, where they say that we made these decisions, but we only made them because there was overwhelming public response forcing us to make these decisions, when in reality, you look at the actual timeline of events, they made the decision, they enacted the decision, like Blairism almost, and then they turn around and say, well, we only did it because the public wanted us to. Despite the fact that you had organizations, massive organizations, organized by people like Mary Whitehouse, who had tens of thousands of people in her genuinely grassroots organization saying, no, we don't want this. This is corrupting. This is against everything that we stand for as a moral people. The British people do not want this. The BBC says, BBFC says, well, we decided you do want this anyway. And so we're going to liberalize it even more. And I agree.
I actually wrote an essay about Mary Whitehouse and this early on in the year, oddly enough.
She's an interesting figure, and I need to look a bit more into her and her background, but she's very fascinating. But, you know, I agree that I don't think the idea of something like the BBFC is particularly bad. And in the video that we spoke about all of this, we both basically said that, yeah, if you're watching a film and there's a rape scene or a horrible gore scene, if it's necessary for the story, do you need to show it in as graphic detail as we get these days? Is that really the artistic necessity? And if you're in charge, if you're in charge of the censorship board for this, you might be able to make individual exceptions if you get a film across that really does necessitate it for the artistic merit that it demonstrates. But to apply carte blanche for all of these to just do whatever they want, that's once again, that's just opening yourself up to subversion.
Yeah, completely. And the thing is, the answer is you just don't need to show in graphic detail the most horrific things. And I remember seeing an interview once with some guy who was, it was a Doctor Who DVD, and it was an interview that they'd included with one of the actors on there. And he said, you can get away, you can show anything, but you don't need to be obscene. You can show anything and say anything without being obscene. And I thought, that's actually true.
Yeah.
It's a very simplistic statement, but it's actually true. You don't need to show the thing. You can just allude to it, and the audience gets the idea. So a lot of this is just gratuitous and tasteless and there for shock value, and always was.
And that's what the whole video nasty craze was about. It was these people, because the market forces, when you appeal to the free market, I think what you're appealing to is the lowest common denominator. People respond to novelty. They respond to shock. They get desensitized to things. So you get one thing that comes across, pushes all of the boundaries, and everybody goes to see that because they want to see the boundaries being pushed. And then, but no, that's once that boundary's been pushed, that's not where the boundary is anymore. It becomes boring. People don't care. So somebody else comes along and pushes it even further and even further and even further.
Yeah,
and then where does it end?
Yeah, exactly. It's a race to the bottom. And I remember exactly what you were talking about, where the BBFC, each new director, I think is the term,
of the BBFC, is, yeah,
would be more liberal than the last one. And so you'd get this ever shifting standard, where it was always the next logical step. The next logical step is to be more liberal. And obviously, that wasn't acceptable 20 years ago, but things have changed.
How do we measure that? Well, I've decided that things have changed, so I guess the public must agree with me.
Yeah, and of course, they could only change in one direction. We could never become more strict about gore and violence than we were. We've got to become less so. That's the only conceivable direction in which society could go.
There is one interesting thing with that, which I've seen, is that apparently my generation, Gen Z, I think I'm Gen Z, 96, I might be millennial still, I might be Gen Z, but the people closer to my generation are apparently asking for less sex in films and television now because it makes them uncomfortable to watch. I've seen that being reported. So it seems that they have reverse engineered themselves into a repressive sexuality, whilst at the same time loads of girls are going off and starting OnlyFans and such. It's a very strange social milieu that we live in at the moment.
That is interesting. That's an interesting phenomenon, and I wonder about that, because I've also heard that Gen Z are having much less sex than the millennials.
Yes, that's probably
much less than Gen X.
Yeah, and that's probably a lot to do with the mass proliferation of pornography. Because a lot of the people in that comment section, again, a lot of them were saying like, oh, how am I? Girls don't like me. Girls don't want anything to do with me. How am I supposed to release my sexual urges if I don't have access to a constant stream of 24-hour hardcore BDSM pornography and all sorts? If I can't watch Cenk Uygur's most fervent dreams, then what's the point of living? And I think to myself, man, it's not actually that hard to talk to women. It's actually very easy to talk to a lot of women. And one of the things that I've learned from speaking to a lot of women is that they can tell if you watch a lot of porn. They can tell if you are a 24/7 coomer behind closed doors. And it really creeps them out. it really they don't like to think about that sort of stuff. You know, this is why all of those girls that do OnlyFans, they have nothing but contempt for the people actually paying for it, because they know that they're disgusting. A lot of them end up being quite disgusting people. And this isn't to pass, you know, blank judgment on everybody who watches pornography. I know a lot of people struggle with it, but it really does mess your brain up. You can't think properly. You can't form thoughts properly. It affects your memory. It affects your day-to-day behavior. So to those people who were saying, oh, what am I supposed to do without pornography? Well, you stop watching pornography. You stop watching pornography. And if you spend enough time doing that, your brain will actually mend itself. And you might be able to devote that time that you spent watching that stuff to developing a skill or working on your personality or even just going to the gym and becoming someone that women are interested in talking to.
Or just conversing with people, just chatting to people. I mean, that's time better spent than, you know, chugging one out and finding 10 videos to assist you while you do that. I mean, yeah, it'd be best to learn about just how to behave normally and get along with people. Yeah, definitely. I also think this is especially a danger with when you're young, because, you know, it's famous that the brain is plastic, especially when you're a teenager. And I think that this is not nearly often enough discussed, that appetites grow with the feeding, and that means that you alter yourself by what you do. I don't think people realize this, at least not how profound, that is a very profound statement. And
it's very easy to become a glutton. And the more you get into those patterns and habits of behavior, the more difficult it's going to be if you ever want to stop them.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And again, the same is true of gore in films. And people always say, oh, are you saying that if I watch a guy chainsawing people to death, I'm going to go out and do it myself? And that's not the issue. Of course you're not going to do it yourself. It's a matter of the coarsening of society and the coarsening of attitude. And this is demonstrable. I mean, I've seen it in my lifetime. People aren't as polite as they used to be. The general tenor of society is more rough and gritty than it used to be. It's less civilized, less civil. This is just clear. And for anyone older than me, this always amazes me. And it was why I did my very first essay on Substack, was on this matter. I'm 40. If I see decline and it's visible to me, then what about someone who's 50, 60, 70, 80? They know a world that I never knew. They knew the world of the 40s and the 50s. How can they say that we haven't declined? How can they not see the change? And I'm sure they must, and they're just under a whole load of delusion about it. And they'll say, yeah, it has changed, but it's better now. But then, as you say, you walk down the street, it doesn't feel better. It doesn't feel better in it at all.
It certainly doesn't. I think some of those, I know that there will be some people of that age range who do see what's gone on, but a lot of them will probably be emerged in boomerisms. Let's be perfectly honest. A lot of these people will be boomers who just think that things always just get better and that I came from the best generation and my beliefs are now the prevalent beliefs. And so that must mean that everything is better. I thought in the 1960s that everything needed to just be more free love and tolerance, man. And now there is more free love and tolerance, man. So I must have got what I wanted, right? So why am I so miserable?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And what I wanted must have been right. And so if I've now got it, then things must be better. So it must be great. It doesn't make sense. Nothing else would make sense. But I do think, see, that's the other thing. When I was young, old people who were like born in the 20s, the 1920s, they would be more pessimistic and downbeat about the present than the current old people, who are the boomers. And I think this is part of it. I think that older generation were able to see, yeah, things aren't, because they weren't children of the 60s. So they weren't wedded to this idea of constant liberalization. So they could admit freely, yeah, things are worse. And they always did. But it's now that people, you know, 60s and 70s are the boomer generation. They are the ones who've, I think they must be the first generation of old people who aren't lamenting the decline and the loss of the past for a long time, because they are so wedded, as you say, to the idea that things must have got better.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a shame to me that being born when I was, that I never even got access to those people. All of my grandparents have sadly passed away, and none of them were born in the 1920s. The only parts of my family that would have been around that sort of age, I think they all died right before I was born. So I was completely untethered from that. And I love my parents to absolute pieces, but the problem with boomer parents is that they never really feel the need to teach you about anything that came before you. They never really feel the need to go like, oh, this is how things were back in the day. Here's how history was. Here's what went down. A lot of them would leave you to the public school system and trust that, well, I had a decent enough education, so I'm sure that my kids are getting a decent enough education, and not pay that much more or attention to it. And I'm not saying that my parents are guilty of that entirely, but it's certainly, there were a lot of blanks missing for me. But once again, to bring it back to what I was talking about, and to bring it back around to Germany, that I was talking about earlier, was that as far as I can tell, this has all been a process of social engineering, the social engineering of society. And AA has spoken about this, and I will be speaking about this when I eventually get the bloody video out once I've done all the research for it, which is that post-war Germany was an amazing petri dish. It was an experiment for all of this social engineering. And a lot of people go on about the Frankfurt School. Frankfurt School this, Frankfurt School that. They talk about the ideas that they developed. They talk about Marcuse and repressive tolerance. And all of that is very important. But not enough people talk about how they were involved with the precursor to the CIA during World War II, working for the US government while they were in exile from Germany during the war efforts, and how they were explicitly consulted, I think it was, during the post-war period, on how that they would be able to brainwash the population of Germany into not being Nazis.
Yeah, the denazification program.
Yeah, the denazification. And, you know, whether people want to say that was justified or not, because we were doing it to Nazis. Sorry to break it to you. These people say explicitly they think that you're a Nazi for believing the things that you do. So they are more than happy to brainwash you. Whether you want to say it was justified or not, this was the experiment where all of this stuff that we're experiencing now was tested out for the first time. They had all of the same disgusting sex taught to them. If I get up a quote here, and this was in quite a mainstream book, actually. Helen Joyce, in her book Trans, speaks about this. It's a shame that she didn't go into more detail on it, because it's a very interesting passage, and I've got a load of the links that she used, and it's very interesting. But she says, in the late 1960s, so there's just over 20 years after the war, enough time for all of this social engineering to have been in effect for about a single generation, some European liberals thought that breaking down sexual taboos was a task that had to be started young. Now, this is something that we know Freud and all of those subversives all wanted to promote from very early in the 20th century. This idea, Freud had the idea of the pansexuality of all children, that all children are sexual beings, and it's part of the sexual development as they got older. Basically, this very early part of trying to sexualize kids from when they're as young as possible. And this started to get implemented because the Frankfurt School were really influenced by Freud. They thought that Nazism was caused by repressive sexuality because, you know, they weren't happy about people transing people in disgusting barbaric procedures in Weimar Germany. So it must be because that they had too good a relationship with their father, and their father didn't sodomize them. That must be why they ended up being Nazis. that's the logic, really, though, isn't it? He says, European liberals thought breaking down sexual taboos was a task that had to be started young. In German kindergartens run along radical left lines, teachers encourage children to fondle them, view pornography, and simulate sexual intercourse. Contemporaneous accounts show that parents often felt qualms, which they suppressed because of what they had been told about how children should naturally behave. So their parents were all brainwashed into thinking that if you stand up to this, then you're just going to commit Auschwitz again. So they had to stand aside as their kids were had terrible things done to them, terrible things taught to them, because they were brainwashed into hating themselves. And that seems to be very analogous to what we're experiencing now. You deserve this, white man, because your entire history is one of oppression, of colonization, of genocide, murdering other people. All of your ancestors were slave owners, and if they weren't slave owners, then they were supporting or benefited from the slave trade. So therefore, you don't have a say in us brainwashing your kids and teaching them to hate themselves or teaching them that they need to cut off their genitals.
Absolutely. I think the way this is framed is, well, what is white culture? White culture is domination, racism, white supremacy, sexism, transphobia, homophobia, imperialism, and so forth. It's basically everything bad. And we're actually at the stage now where they're so cartoonish as to say that there's pretty much nothing good about what you would call white culture, whether it's in France or America or Britain. And therefore, we are entirely on the back foot and on trial, and we have to prove our innocence by the degree to which we go along with new ideas. So that's
it's a form of karmic retribution.
Yeah,
it's karmic retribution that we're getting what we want, whilst at the same time being told that it's actually good that this is happening to us, because this is a more progressive and more enlightened way of living your life and viewing the world. So it's amazing how people can hold these two arguments in their head at the same time and see no contradictions. But I think these people do often see the contradictions. They just don't care because they hate us. At the end of the day, one of the things that I've been really trying to hammer home recently is that I think one of the great... one of the great innovations of Western society, particularly British society, is that we have a genuinely individual culture where we care about people for who they are and we respect them for their own personal accomplishments without everybody having to leech off of them. I think radical collectivism is one of the things that's kept other cultures down. It's like when you read about accounts from Central or Eastern Africa, where you've got these tribes where anybody who starts to make anything of themselves immediately has to be dragged down by the rest of the tribe. And what this does, it keeps them perpetually poor because nobody can do anything to improve anybody else's conditions because everybody's jealous of them improving their own conditions first. Whereas in England and Scotland and other places, it was kind of the opposite. We celebrate that. We celebrate people going out and doing their own thing and improving themselves and improving everybody else's lives through doing that. But the really radical individualism that we experience has made it so easy to subvert us. Because I've been trying to promote recently that you can still have that individualism. And you can still recognize people for who they are as individuals and not as part of a group. But you do need to recognize yourself as part of a group. Because whether you want to or not, everybody else in the world sees you as part of a group that they despise. And they see as ground zero for everything that is wrong in their lives. And what happens then? What happens then is that they're pouring into your countries. So even if you wanted to just ignore that, you can't. Because soon, Serco is going to be bringing it next door.
Absolutely. And also within a group, radical individualism is damaging because, of course, it negates the existence of the group. So, for example, we can celebrate people being clever, being entrepreneurial, being resourceful, being creative. And, of course, we should. But the extreme of that is that they just use their abilities to exploit their fellows, their peers. And you know, I always think of this example of HS2. No one wants it, but some entrepreneurs want to make profit, and they're willing to screw over everyone else and destroy the countryside, ruin our historical areas, tear at the fabric of our identity, our heritage, in order to make a profit. That cannot be right. I mean, their individualistic drives should obviously be subordinated to the greater good.
Absolutely. I mean, this is an interesting example because I've done some videos on HS2 recently. There were some really good tweet threads put out by people showing just how much of a waste of resources it is and how it's basically being used as an opportunity to funnel money to preferred ethnic groups and to preferred NGOs, as you always expect. But personally, I've had some terrible things happen because of HS2. I'm from Cheshire. I'm mainly from a town called Crewe. I have, it's a bit of a desolate wasteland now. Put it like this. Back in, I think it was 2017, Sean Connery was there filming a post-apocalyptic thriller, and they didn't have to do anything other than put up a bit of a green screen to make it look post-apocalyptic. They've destroyed the entire town center.
I remember just as an intervention, I remember it was mentioned in the song It's Grim Up North by the KLF. That'll be before
was it really?
Your time. Yeah, that'll be before your time, but it's mentioned there.
it wasn't actually that grim a town. It used to be quite nice. Even when I was still a teenager, it still had something. The town centre still had some shops in it and independent businesses, the sweet shops that have been there for decades. It's all gone now. It's all gone because HS2 was supposed to be coming through Crewe as part of the big link-up between London and Manchester, because it's supposed to be London, Birmingham, Manchester, and Crewe was going to be the big connector between all that, because Crewe's famed for its railway. And as a result of that, the council decided that they wanted to tear up the entire town centre. They knocked down a load of the independent arcade, where all of the independent shops were, and heartbreakingly for me, I'm a musician. I've been playing in bands since I was a teenager. I've got lots of fantastic memories in an old venue that was by the train station. It's on the corner next to the train station called The Box. It's where I played some of my first gigs, where I met some of my best friends, where I forged some of my strongest bonds. And it's gone now because the people who owned it decided that they would make more money, instead of it being a venue, being a car park for when HS2 passes through, so that all of these people who are going to be using HS2 can park there cheap. They knocked the place down after they bought it, and then HS2 isn't even coming up to Crewe anymore. It's either not coming to Manchester and just going from London to Birmingham, or it's bypassing Crewe and going straight to Manchester. So all of that, all of the destruction, all of the memories, and this isn't even in a place that, you know, it's not like traditional Britain, but this was somewhere where people
something
knew
that
each
meant
other.
A lot to you.
Yeah, there was a community. There was a community of people. There was a community of people that organized themselves around this music scene, around these venues, around these independent shops. And it's all gone now for the sake of something that isn't coming into town anymore. And the council, it's been 6 years. It's been 6 or 7 years even, and the town centre has been desolate for that whole time.
That is just a dreadful story. There are so many different bits that I could rant about, but I won't. I'll just empathise with you, because I think it's...
Thanks.
And I know exactly what you mean, because I've got a lot of affection for places that I've known in the past that weren't the most picturesque. They weren't the most lovely architecture, but it was a place that meant a lot to me. And I think probably everyone's got this, some example, similar example in their own lives. And this is why I hate change. You know, I try to be more open-minded about it, more open to it. But generally, change means loss. It means destruction of something. And yeah, sure, sometimes it's for the better, of course, but there's always a price. And I think we've become accustomed as a society to not thinking about the price. What are we paying? What are we losing for a modern glass and steel building that works well? It does its job well, but what are we losing? We're losing a beloved old building that everyone knew, and everyone had a memory of some time they spent in that building. These things really matter and should matter. And of course, what often happens is that the replacement doesn't last very long because no one is attached to it.
Yeah. I'm very similar to you. I've always been quite averse to change, even from a very young age. I remember when I was a child, I think this should have been indicative of how I was going to end up very early on. As a child, my parents got a new car and I cried. Because I really liked the old car, though. Where's the old car gone? Why are you getting rid of it?
I can relate.
At this point, you know, I'm not entirely averse to change, because I know you can't go back to the past. Things can't always stay the same. Change, we're always in perpetual motion. But it's the fact that everything has changed. There's no thought, as you say, to the cost of what's being paid to make sure this change happens. And then it just wouldn't feel so bitter to me if the things that I've seen changed had things put in place, even something that did end up temporary. My change that I've seen in my hometown has been a continual process of destruction. The arcades, the independent shops, the places that I used to spend time at with my friends, all destroyed. And what for? Was something worthwhile put there in place? Was something even temporary put there? No. What stands in the place of my old favorite music venue from my old hometown is not even a shitty multi-story car park. It is a load of gravel, is what they've put there. So that makes it sting all the worse.
I'm frightened to ask, but how old were these buildings?
I don't even know how old they were. I think the box had been there for a couple of decades at least. I'm not going to say that they were any magnificent Victorian buildings that had been there since the 19th century. Although I do have on this bookshelf here a picture book of Crewe in the 20th century, and you can see the change even going back then, how opposite the town hall, which is actually quite a nice, magnificent building, there used to be some very nice buildings, like here. I think that's the that one there. Oh, God, the light. Yes. That's the town hall. And opposite that was this.
Oh, yes. Oh, this. Lovely. Lovely.
A lovely building. By the time I was born, that's gone. That was a library that's now derelict, that was an awful bit of brutalist architecture. I think that might have been because of the war, where, you know, places got bombed, Crewe had a big rail infrastructure, so things got bombed, things got knocked down. But the thing is, just because something's been knocked down, it's, you don't have to put a big, ugly, grey block where it once was. You can just build something nice there again.
Yeah.
For some reason, in the post-war, there was just this urge for them to say, okay, we had all of these beautiful old buildings put knocked down. Is this a chance to create something new and beautiful? No, it's a chance to create something new and hideous.
Honestly, you've dialed into one of my pet topics, which I have a reputation on Telegram for ranting about architecture. And one of the things is this phenomenon of post-war widespread demolition, not even due to bomb damage. Buildings that were perfectly okay, including in my bloody hometown of Linlithgow, rural Scotland. I won't get into that. The point is that it was all over the country. And even in Canada, I heard the same thing happen there. They had loads all over Canada, loads of old buildings that had, you know, original Canada sort of era. And in the 50s and 60s, they just tore them down. Same in America as well, actually, I believe, in at least some states. But Britain was really wrecked after the war, not by the Germans. I think it's important to say that, yeah, they did damage. But our own bloody town councillors and town planners and architects did, I think, even more damage.
I can certainly agree. Once again, it's just, even if it had been bombed, even if it had been knocked down, why do you need to put something so hideous where it was? Why are we only putting up something that you walk past and it makes you grimace? It turns your stomach to view it. And it's because they don't want us to connect to the past.
It doesn't inspire. It doesn't reassure. It doesn't comfort. Yep. It's not pleasant.
And I do think that was part of the social engineering. Because if you're in an environment that makes you uncomfortable, then that puts you on a bad foot for anything. If you can't even feel comfortable where you are, then that's a bad start for anything.
Definitely. I was just looking through my architecture folder. I have several comparison images where something to compare a specific place. But interestingly, some of them are reversed, where there was some hideous, brutalist thing, but they've knocked it down and replaced it with something nice.
Can do that.
Yeah, yeah. It's actually happening now, especially in Germany. Here's one from Germany. That's the town of Hildesheim in Lower Saxony. And it was as above, and then it's now as below.
That's a big improvement.
Yeah, definitely. And then here's one from, this is Britain, Bromley. I think this is the other way around, unfortunately, where it was a lovely Victorian building and it's now what the fuck you see in the lower
half. That is one of the greatest downgrades I've ever seen in my entire life.
Yeah, yeah.
And the thing is, you don't need something so brutalist and utilitarian to have a boot sin. Yeah, it might come across a bit strange, but in Nantwich, which is the town over from Crewe, it's still lots of old Tudor buildings. And what do they have in the Tudor buildings? Yeah, they've got boots in it. They've got a cafe in it that may look a bit out of place. But it's a lot nicer to have those shops in somewhere that's beautiful and inspiring than this.
It really matters as well. You know, because I can imagine someone saying, well, you sound really gay talking about beauty. But it really does matter. It changes the whole tenor of your daily life.
All of the great men of history probably had an opinion on beauty, probably cared deeply for beauty. So just saying, oh, that's gay, bro, that's a very modern opinion.
Yeah, it's a dumbass opinion. One final thing is the Birmingham Central Library. The concrete one has now been demolished and replaced with something, if you can believe it, even worse. But the original was this incredible, really nice Victorian, big Victorian building, which I do have a photo of. Hold on a second. I've got actually a dedicated folder to the Birmingham Library, which is funny because I've never even been to Birmingham.
I've been quite a few times. Whenever I drive home down the M5 through to the M6, I have to pass through Birmingham, and I say my prayers right before I get there as well, just in case. You never know what's going to happen.
Yeah, it has that reputation. So there you go. That's the original Victorian building. You can see it's big and grand, but not ugly.
Not hideous. Glorious.
It's lovely. And imagine being in that porch there on the left there at the front. You're going to go in and then that's terrific. Lovely.
We lost a lot.
Yeah, we did. We did. So, well, anyway, this has been a lovely, really enjoyable stream. So thank you for doing this.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. I've really enjoyed this discussion as well. It took a few tangents I wasn't expecting, but they were all very welcome.
Yeah, definitely. And people have been saying in the live chat they've enjoyed it as well. So please follow Harry on Twitter and look out for his work. The project that you've got about the LGBT history, that sounds like something that would be ideal for Substack, I've got to say. I don't know if you've got that or if you're considering doing that. But
well, I'll see about it in the future. At the moment, I'm planning on it being for the Lotus Eaters. So if it ends up on there, it'll be premium, so you'll have to subscribe to the website. It's £5 a month to get access to everything on there, and there's lots of really great stuff, including the stuff that I've done, so it's well worth it. But it's taking its time. That's the thing. With all of this research, you end up with a mountain of books that you have to read through, the hundreds of articles, dozens of videos. It takes its time, and like you say, you initially think, I thought, oh, it's going to be maybe two episodes, maybe a two-part thing where I can get it all recorded in one day, release one month, the next one the next month. That's not what it's ended up being at all. It's going to be probably at least 8 or 10 episodes. So I'll see.
Fantastic. I can still identify. I know exactly how it happens. And I hope that they let you do that, just let you get on with it, because that sounds great. Fantastic. Yeah, well, that's an alternative history of LGBT.
I hope I can get the proper scope for it, because I want to do this sort of stuff justice, as I'm sure you with your loony left in the 80s do as well. I'm really interested to hear all about that. But yeah, thanks again very much for having me on. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, it's been great. Thank you. But first, there are a couple of super chats.
Okay. All right. Sorry, I don't want to cut it off too early.
Yeah, I should have announced that. Let's see. Okay, this is from Lurker. Cheers, Woz. I've been watching you for what must be 8 years now. That would be, 2015? Yeah. still afraid to add my own voice to the conversation. Maybe one day I will. Merry Christmas. Thank you very much. Oliver says, are you staying active musically, Harry, since your previous band treated you badly? It's not easy for right-wing musicians, that's for sure.
Yes, that is true. Not to go into too much detail there, but I did. I am still friends with a few of the members of that old band. You probably don't know the details of that, but basically, the manager of the band knew what I was doing when we signed up with him, but hadn't obviously watched any of it. But then, because of then when he caught one of the videos that appeared on YouTube and heard me saying very disparaging things about the queer community, he demanded that I be kicked out of the band. Or quit my job and apologize for everything that I'd said. And so I said, I'm not going to do that second part. So I ended up having to leave them. But I'm still friends with a few of them. And they told me that after that happened, because of my association with certain figures from the online right, that some people in festivals had told them they can't play there anymore. And they can now, but they ended up having to clear that up because they thought I was still in the band. It's absolutely ridiculous, especially because when I was still playing with them, I actually got recognized quite frequently at the gigs by members of the crowd and also the techs who were working at the venues. And they were all really friendly and they were all big fans of the show and were really happy to meet me. So there's still a really good contingent of right-wingers in the metal community, as you would expect. But it's like everywhere else, the people who are actually making the decisions and running these organizations are shitlibs. But yeah, I'm actually trying to keep up my my music. It's going to be solo stuff. I'm currently working on... I've actually got 3 or 4 new songs written. No lyrics or vocals, because I'm a terrible lyricist and vocalist. But I've got all the music written for them. I've recorded a load of bass and guitars. Program the drums, trying to collaborate with a particular insane Australian who might collaborate with AA as well, that you may be aware of. But we'll see what happens with that. He's a very, very busy man. So we'll see what happens. But hopefully I'll either get like some kind of 4-track EP out sometime next year, or maybe even an album. That's what I'd be aiming for. I don't know if I'd be able to play it live. If I could, that'd be amazing, if I could get a band. But you never know with these things. If nothing else, I just want to get my music out there, because I love music, I love playing guitar, I love everything about it.
All right. Good, excellent. Daniel asks, do you think classic horror films are subversive? Are they mere warnings? I can't help but use the box from Hellraiser as a metaphor for contemporary trends. Fantastic stream, guys. The Millennial Express introduction is so cozy. Merry Christmas. Thank you very much. I was a bit concerned that the intro was too long, but people don't seem to think so. So that's nice. It's a relief.
No, it's fine.
Do you think classic horror films are subversive? I guess it really depends on the film. It's a bland answer. But you go.
Rosemary's Baby, yes. But The Exorcist, no. Yeah, it depends. It depends on the film. Even a lot of the slasher films from the 1980s, because of the tropes that they were using, you can read very reactionary themes into them. There's the classic one of the promiscuity gets you killed.
Yeah, definitely. It's kind of weird actually to see those now and think that they you know, when we were kids, they seemed so outrageous, but now they're actually kind of oddly conservative, in a sense. It's quite weird. Penelope, thank you very much for Millennial. Thank you, Penelope. And then Darby says, they gutted what little the town had for no reason, man. That's awful. Can relate. Modern cities I find really depressing. This is something that's, as we said, it's been happening for decades, and it I think it has slowed. I don't think it happens so flagrantly now as it did in the 60s. But it's, yeah, as I say, we've paid a permanent fucking price for all of that. The Mikado. I'd be interested to know when the it's the current year argument was first widely used. Back in the 90s, it was everywhere. Excessively foul language on TV, violence, sexual scenes. Hey, it's the 90s was the simple go-to retort. Yeah, people might think that it started with Justin Trudeau when he said, because it's 2015. But actually, yeah, I remember people in the 90s saying, hey, it's the 90s. What do you expect? It's the 90s. What else could happen? It's the 90s. Yeah, I don't know. You see, I would need to be older than I am in order to look back further.
I have a feeling that that might just be an argument that gets trotted out in every era by progressive reformers, because they're just appealing to the fallacy of progress for progress sake. It's this year, which is after these other years happened, therefore things have changed.
Yeah, exactly. It just doesn't actually, it's not an argument. It's just a sort of statement of, what do you expect? It's the current year. Yes, boneheaded. Aethelward says he's looking to start his own channel in 2024. Yes, that looks interesting. Good luck with that. Insightful World, an honest question for Harry. He's mentioned Schmidt, Evola, and endorses Imperium Press. Is Harry trying to tell the audience to not exactly be a sensible centrist? Let you take that.
I think I wouldn't put myself down to any particular label. I would say I care about Britain and I care about the British people. I care about our well-being and I care about our continuity.
Excellent. That sounds like a good place to end. So, Harry, this has been a great stream. Thank you very much. I'll be back in 15 minutes with the next stream. And I actually can't remember who it is. Hold on. Oh, it's Ban the BBC. But in the meantime, Harry Robinson, I know many people have enjoyed this and I've enjoyed it. So thank you for appearing on Millennial 2023.
Oh, thank you very much. And thanks everyone for tuning in as well. It's been a great pleasure of mine.
Okay, great. Thank you. See you all later.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated.
All aboard.
Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.